3. I count the fat flowers, follow the winding vines patterned on the carpet downstairs in the bar. I'm waiting for my friends to arrive. I waste a lot of time being early. To get to the bar, I had to walk through the lounge, which projects a different atmosphere from the rest of the hotel, with its weathered leather couches, stone fireplace, taxidermy, all rustic appeal. The lounge is a remnant of the building's original form and intention. Not much has been done to it. No pastel paint or eccentric art. Absolutely no flowers. It's got a masculinity to it, which, honestly, is refreshing after the tour of rooms earlier. The bar, alternatively, is a return to what's typical of this place. Too much. The walls are painted black, the ceiling is low, enforcing intimacy. The long mahogany bar snakes around the corner. It's fenced in by bronze-legged bar stools with red leather upholstery on the seats and seat backs, tufted with small bronze buttons. Above the bar, thick blue fabric drapes from the ceiling. I suspect to cover the generic track lighting that illuminates the liquor-lined shelves. The room isn't particularly large. There's maybe 3 feet between the stools and the sets of round glass tables with mismatched armchairs against the wall. I'm sandwiched in. I read and reread the cocktail menu, resist the bowl of mixed nuts. Who knows who stuck their fingers in that bowl before I got here? "Where's everyone else?" May asks. She's wearing a lace maxi dress and a suede moto jacket. Her hair is elaborately braided. "What am I, not good enough?" She sighs. "That's not what I meant." Frankly, my feelings are hurt. "I'm 10 minutes late, that's all." "Have you met our friends?" She purses her lips. "Sit down," I tell her, patting the stool next to mine. She climbs up and I offer her the drink menu. She pushes up her glasses. They're different from the ones she had on earlier. Black, squarish. She had to have eye surgery when she was young. She doesn't talk much about it. It's one of the things she pretends she's come to terms with. It came up during one of my recent visits to Manhattan. "I know it could be worse," she told me, ever brave and graceful, sipping a pink cocktail out of a speakeasy champagne coupe. "You can be upset," I told her. "You can feel bad for yourself every once in a while." She shook her head. "No, I can't." Later that night, when I was out of cigarettes, she agreed to go with me to the corner bodega to get another pack. I bought Marlboro Golds and a couple of scratch-offs for the hell of it. "What should we buy when we win?" I asked her, scanning the sidewalk for a coin to use. Neither of us had one. She said, pulling the cigarette from my mouth and taking a drag. "A magic lamp, so we can get a genie for wishes." "Are you making fun of me?" "No, some wishes would be nice." She tossed the cigarette. "You should really quit smoking." "Lavender," she says, snapping me back to the present. "I like drinks with lavender. My grandma used to make this lemon lavender punch. She said it was her special recipe, passed down through generations, but she definitely used tea bags and country time lemonade. The powder mix that comes in those plastic barrels. You know what I'm talking about?" "Yeah, tastes like summer." "What are you gonna have?" "Starting without me?" Molly asks, sitting on the opposite side of me. I like being in the middle. "You're late," May says. "I took a power nap. I'm ready to start drinking. What we got?" Molly reaches for the menu. "Oh, wow, egg whites and shit. Pinky up, cool glasses, May."
"Thank you."
"What are you getting, Lise?" I shrug. "The signature one?" "Which one is that?" "The red honey, only one with whiskey." "Honey, whiskey, orange bitters, cherry. Into it. I'll have that too." Molly signals the bartender, a guy with a beard that acts as his only defining characteristic.
Should we wait for Julie?
May asks. Molly pauses. I can tell she forgot about Julie. Her eyes widen and her right brow twitches upward. It's an embarrassment she's about to play off. Her lips flatten.
Nah,
she says, she won't care. The three of us know that to be untrue. Julie and I are equally sensitive about inclusion. We always need to be invited, even if it's to a sushi restaurant, and we both hate sushi. Even if it's to go see a movie we've explicitly said we don't want to see. If we're not invited, we get mopey. If we're meeting at a bar or a restaurant, we expect to be greeted outside, not at the bar or the table, even if we're late. This is more a Julie thing because I'm never late. But none of us objects. We order our drinks and gossip about the famous people Molly has run into in Hollywood. We pretend we aren't distracted by Julie's absence. When we get our drinks, we take tiny sips.
Should I call her?
May asks, interrupting a story of a washed-up sitcom star jerking off in a parking garage. Yeah, Molly says immediately. She's running out of stories, or she's sick of telling them. May raises her phone to her ear. There's a ringing behind us.
I'm here,
Julie says, rushing up. She kisses May on the cheek and sits on the stool next to her. She waves over the bartender and orders a vodka soda.
Sorry, I'm late.
We wait for an explanation. We don't get one. Worse, vodka sodas are Julie's drink of choice when she's trying to lose weight. And right now, her sweater hangs so I can see the pronounced V of her collarbone. I watch her hand tremble as she reaches for her drink. I catch the shine of her engagement ring, a princess-cut diamond with tapered ruby baguettes, an heirloom from Tristan's great-grandmother. I've never seen it in person before. I almost ask for a closer look, almost stretch my hand across the bar for her hand, but something stops me. Whiskey swirls in my stomach. Julie holds her glass up too high. She's chugging her drink. A teardrop of vodka falls down her chin. Molly squeezes my thigh under the bar, trying to tell me something I already know.
I need to catch up,
Julie says, and orders another drink. We're still on our first, I say, but she doesn't seem to hear me. There are a few moments of silence May can't stand. She taps her nails on the bar, examines the sprig of lavender in her drink. We did part of the shoot in here, she says. November issue, I'll send you copies.
What are the winter trends?
Molly asks, elbows on the bar. May sticks her tongue out at her.
Hey, just because I don't dress up doesn't mean I'm not interested in fashion.
Interested in it as comedy material?
May asks.
No, Molly says. I won't make fun. I like when you give us your trend forecast. Jewel tones, that was one.
If you really want to know, winter colors are bold. Teal is the color of the season. Rose gold is out. Yellow gold, we're going to see a return to yellow gold. But really, we're already looking at spring. A lot of geometric patterns, more playful but modern silhouettes. Asymmetric hems, shoulder pads.
Shoulder pads? Molly asks, really?
May nods.
Huh, Molly says. Is it time? Is the world ready?
May leans in. Is it ever? Julie has already finished her second drink. She keeps raising the glass to her lips and tilting her head back, as if there's a last sip eluding her. The whiskey isn't sitting right in my stomach, all by itself.
I'm hungry, I say. It's kind of early, but I didn't have lunch.
Me either, Julie says, slapping a hand down on the bar.
We had McDonald's, but that won't stop me, Molly says. May?
I could eat, she says. We settle our tabs, and May leads us out of the bar and into the dining room. It's savagely lavish. Circular booths twirl around the room, each covered in a clean white cloth and set neatly with mismatched vintage china, closely supervised by napkin swans. The seats are upholstered with magenta vinyl, cute but borderline tacky. The wallpaper is blush damask. Eclectic chandeliers swarm the ceiling, gold, silver, bronze, crystal. String lights occupy every spare inch in between. Some the classic white, others shaped like stars or flowers. Despite the efforts of the bulbs, the windowless room remains dim, with a milky pink quality to the light. The bartender told us to sit anywhere, so we pick a booth near the back. A cluster of tea light candles burn on the table. Without them, reading the menu would be hopeless. There are three choices every night. They rotate, May says. I hope one day she settles down, gets a finance wife and a Hamptons house. She's destined to host dinner parties. Shoes off at the door, no wine outside the dining room, sliced cucumber-based hors d'oeuvres, the tiniest salad forks that make you feel like a giant. Carefully planned courses, finished off with coffee she'll grind herself. She wants to be bohemian, but at her core, she feeds on order. I love that about her. They each come with soup or salad and a side. She reaches over and touches my hand, points to the menu. She's asking me, without asking, to read it for her. She's having trouble seeing. It's too dark. I take a sip of water. It's lukewarm. Been on the table for a while. I use the flashlight on my phone to read vegetable Wellington, pork chop, strip steak. What are you getting? She asks me. Vegetable Wellington sounds interesting. I kind of want fries ever since you mentioned McDonald's. Sides are baked potato, fries, sauteed spinach, sauteed kale with garlic or mashed cauliflower. Soup today is pumpkin. Pumpkin? Molly asks. Can you eat pumpkin? You've never had pumpkin? Fuck no, Molly says. No pumpkin pie, I ask. Never even seen it? She shakes her head. Yuck. You're ridiculous. Molly doesn't like weird food. She likes meat and potatoes and rice and pasta and eggs and toast and turkey sandwiches and anything that comes in a plastic wrapper. It's the food she was raised on, and she doesn't stray from the path. No room for adventure on her plate. It's a fixed price. I try to mask my embarrassment for having to ask. I unfold a napkin on my lap like I belong, like I'm the first lady. Yes, May says. It's $25 for dinner, $30 including bottomless house wine or one signature cocktail. Lunch is $15, breakfast $10. Settle at checkout. If it's all the same, I'll get the steak, I say. Hear, hear, Molly says, fanning me with her menu. Same, Julie says from behind hers, allowing the three of us to trade quick expressions of confusion, asking one another with wide eyes instead of words, do you think this is weird? The answer is yes, we all think it's weird. Julie is a vegetarian. She found a piece of gristle in a chicken nugget when she was 9, and she was so traumatized, she refused to eat meat from then on out. She climbed further on board after watching a few radical food documentaries sophomore year. Even the not-so-radical ones radicalized her. She tolerated us eating meat, but did not approve. She forced upon us bites of her beloved veggie burgers, of her tofu scramble, which she claimed was so good, but made Molly barf for 20 minutes straight. Under any other circumstance, Julie ordering a steak would have caused the three of us to flip the table. But what can we do? What can we say? Hey, Jules, did you develop a taste for meat while you were out doing whatever it was you were doing, wherever you were doing it, the past couple of years that you don't remember? A guy in a kitchen apron comes to take our order. I'm on the end, so I'm first. I open my mouth to speak. Over the muffled vanilla jazz struggling out of an old speaker system somewhere above us, I can hear Julie's breathing. Not breathing, panting, like she's just run sprints. No, it's more primal, a hungry dog. I stutter out my order. I've lost my appetite for meat and get the vegetable Wellington instead of steak, with a side of fries, because I need them. May orders the same, only with a side of kale, because that's who she is. When it comes to Julie, she's practically shouting,
"I'll have the steak, rare, and 2 baked potatoes with extra butter."
She hands over her menu and relaxes into the booth. Molly's so thrown, it takes her a moment to remember what she wanted.
"I'll have the, I'll have the pork chop? Yes, pork chop, side of fries, thanks. Oh, and I'll have a bourbon, straight, whatever you got." "Sorry, me too."
I don't care what it costs.
"I'll have the lavender gin drink from the bar menu, please." May says, "Thank you."
"Vodka martini," Julie says, smiling. There's something about her teeth. Aside from being chipped, not white anymore, they've shifted. Her canines have come forward, and her lips, they're so chapped, shriveled thin. Even in this dark room from across the table, I can see the flakes of dead skin. And one of her dimples is missing. Did it fall off? I'm being an asshole. What's wrong with me? I shouldn't be picking apart her appearance. I should be grateful that she's here, that I get to be with her again. I'm lucky to be looking at her. And despite the differences, she's still beautiful. Maybe that's what's scaring me.
"So?"
May says, unfolding and refolding her napkin.
"I met someone."
"Oh, what's her name?" Julie asks.
"Her name is Taylor."
"Please don't tell me she's a model," Molly says.
"She's a model."
"You have a problem."
"As I was saying, her name is Taylor. She has her bachelor's in psychology from Columbia. She started modeling to pay for school, but got a few runway shows and campaigns, so she decided to keep going. She's very sweet and mellow."
"How old is she?" I ask. May dates beautiful, confused girls. Usually younger, usually models. These girls like to attach themselves to May because she's special. Hitch their wagon to her star to see what happens, see how far she'll take them. They end up stealing her clothes or her weed, mooch, cheat, decide they're straight. But May won't end things. She waits to be left. She doubts herself. She thinks she'll end up alone. Molly, too, but she got ahead of it. She decided she wants to be alone. I like to pretend I'm like Molly, but deep down, I know I'm like May, hopeful and afraid.
"She's 24.
"Younger," Molly says.
"She's the oldest of 6 siblings. She's from Connecticut. Her parents are teachers. She's very well-read. You could talk books with her, Lise."
"I like her already."
"All I care about is how she treats you," Molly says. "Is she good to you?"
"She is. I asked her out, believe it or not."
"How long have you been dating?"
Julie asks and licks her lips. I think they've split. I think I see blood. I try not to stare.
"About 3 months.
"And we're just hearing about it now?" I ask.
"I didn't want to speak too soon. I wanted to wait until we were official."
"Wow," Julie says. "Exciting." Our drinks arrive. We gather our glasses.
"To Taylor," Molly says. "One lucky girl."
"Oh," May blushes. No, to Julie."
"To being together again," Julie says, lifting her glass.
There's an olive lolling in it like a dead eye.
"Cheers!"
I drink too much too fast. I follow up with water, but it's too late. A headache blossoms behind my forehead, a meticulous twinge right in the middle. I dig 2 Advil out of my purse.
What's wrong?
Julie asks. Nothing, little headache.
Finish your medicine,
Molly says, tapping her glass against mine.
Don't listen to her,
May says. Water, and here. She picks the sprig of lavender out of her glass and holds it up.
Smell this,
she says.
It smells like gin.
Oh, she says, hold on. She digs into her purse and takes out a small vial of something.
This is peppermint oil. I'm going to put a dab on your wrists. Big inhale.
Your headache will disappear, promise. I hold out my wrists. Molly groans.
Essential oils, May? Really?
Yes, really. How you survive in LA is beyond me.
I drink a lot,
Molly says, and gulps her bourbon.
Smell,
May says. I inhale the aroma of the oil. It's a nice smell, but doesn't instantly fix my headache.
Thanks, Mabes,
I tell her.
It helped.
May shoots Molly a smug look. Julie lurches forward, her neck slack, head rolling down. She hits the table and our glasses dance.
Jules?
I reach out for her hand. One is on the table, the other underneath.
Yeah,
she asks, looking up like nothing happened.
You okay?
Yeah, of course,
she says and takes a sip of her martini. Molly kicks me.
Okay,
I say. You need anything? More water?
No, she says. I'm good.
So, are you seeing anyone? The question feels mean. She knows I'm not. Or she doesn't. But I tell her everything. I've always told her everything. If I were dating someone, she would be the first to know.
No,
I say, and snort as if the idea is ridiculous.
Huh,
she says. Her eyes linger on me. I return to my drink. Please, God, let the food come. I crane my neck to see the door to the kitchen. Open, 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 please.
Aren't you gonna ask if I'm seeing someone?
Molly asks.
Are you?
No,
she says, laughing. The kitchen door swings open. The waiter is coming with our food. A true hero. May starts rearranging the glasses on the table, the salt and pepper shakers. She can't help herself. I forgot what I ordered, but I don't even care what it is. I see fries and shove 3 in my mouth.
Actually, I should wash my hands, I say, now that I've already touched my fries with my germ hands.
You've been spending too much time with this one, Molly points to May, who is already squirting hand sanitizer into her palm. It makes an obscene noise, and we giggle like a bunch of first graders.
You want some?
May asks. I open my palm to her. Molly does too. Julie is already eating. She holds her steak knife in a closed fist, sawing at the meat. Pink juice floods her plate. She forks a chunk into her mouth, and her eyes flutter as she chews. I can hear it from here, the click of her jaw. Her back molars grinding. She gulps, and I can see the food travel down her throat, the expansion of her skin as it goes. Molly kicks me under the table again, but she's not looking at Julie. She's looking at me. I don't know what she's trying to tell me. I ignore her. Silverware scrapes, glasses clink. The conversation died, and we're each waiting for someone else to resuscitate it. What can I say? What do I have to talk about? There's nothing new to report. My life is in the same sorry state it's been in for the past 5 years. The quiet between us starts to mean something. I steal a look at Julie, and she's almost done with her steak already. There are drippings on her chin, and she's barely chewing before swallowing. Her head bobs. No, it's jerking. There's a physicality to the way she's eating, an aggression. I've seen her binge a few times, but it was never like this. It was quick, but methodical. There was a pleasure to it, interspersed with brief moments of shame, which became more and more frequent until they took over. There's not the slightest inkling of shame here. May doesn't seem to notice. She focuses on cutting up her food into teeny tiny little pieces. She eats slowly, precisely, her perfect posture exaggerated. When she was young, she went to etiquette school at the insistence of her racist grandmother. All her grandparents were racist, but according to May, this one was the most open about it. She thought I couldn't help but be uncivilized because I wasn't from here. I remember May telling me. I was 7. What 7-year-old is civilized? How are your parents, Mabes? I ask, bottom of the barrel.
They're good,
she says. My dad is planning on retiring again. Every year he says he's going to retire. He's young to retire, no? Molly asks. He's 63, May says. My parents will never retire, Molly says. It's not really in their nature. They've got that immigrant mindset, work, work, work. Have you talked to your dad? Julie asks me. May gives a mini gasp. Molly clears her throat and begins to chug water. My family situation is in the trunk of topics we keep hidden under the floorboards. Along with my fumbles after college, Julie's eating disorder, May's not being out to her conservative parents, and Molly's cancer-consumed childhood. We dance on top of these floorboards, and though sometimes they squeak, we don't acknowledge it. We pretend we've forgotten about the trunk and what's inside it, even though we all know it's there, beating against our denial, like the telltale heart. Okay. Maybe I should have been in Julie's morbid po room. Haven't spoken to him, I say. Did something happen? Do you not remember? I ask, more bitter than curious. Molly and May look terribly uncomfortable. They're communicating now, nonverbally, in their own secret friendship language. I get a pang of jealousy. They're the closest, aren't they? Julie and I used to be on that level, but this girl sitting across the table, inhaling a rare steak, isn't my best friend. She's a stranger. I meant since then, Julie says. She adds a single shoulder shrug. No, I say, not since then. And Lou? She's good, still in Florida. Rick's good. Good, Julie says. She's on to potato one now, peeling off the skin and eating it with her fingers. It's profoundly awkward for everyone at the table. For close friends, the closest friends any of us have, we don't often talk about our life struggles or our emotions. We don't share our feelings, at least not in depth. Only when we're hammered or desperate. We're all repressed, and that's how we like it. That's part of why we're close. We have a mutual understanding. My mom was a teenager when she had me. Then she and my dad bailed, and I was raised by my Aunt Lucia, Lou. My dad went on to have another family in Ohio with a woman he liked better than my mom and kids he liked better than me. My mom was killed in a car accident. She was drunk and got in a car with someone drunk, and they crashed into a tree. The tree, by all accounts, was sober. It was a few weeks shy of my 3rd birthday. I don't remember her. There was no void left by my biological parents. Lou is my mom. She met Rick when I was 8, and he's my dad. He's 15 years her senior and convinced her to move from Maryland to Florida when I went to college. They're happy there, have a nice house, sweet neighbors they play cards with. They go dancing on Fridays. They don't mind the humidity or the lizards. I reached out to my DNA dad when I was 16. Couldn't leave it alone. He was not particularly enthused to hear from me, but regardless, he reluctantly invited me to meet his wife and my half-siblings. I declined. I asked him for financial help. He had never paid a dime of child support. It could go to court, I told him. He gave me $10,000. It went toward my college tuition. We started emailing back and forth, and at one point, it seemed like there might be the promise of a relationship. He gave me money for grad school. I didn't even ask. He offered. What I thought was progress turned out to be a nail in the coffin. He was pissed when I dropped out. The communication stopped after that. Why Julie would bring up my dad over dinner is beyond me. I finish my drink.
We should get another round, Julie says. If we see the guy, let's flag him down.
There's a noise across the dining room. We all turn. A chair is on its side, on the floor. Back from the table, like someone bumped it and it fell, but no one walked by there. I think about my room, about the split second before the door closed when I thought I saw someone standing inside, about my bag falling onto the floor unprompted. This place is haunted, I say.
Haunted hotel, real original, Molly says, rolling her eyes. No, no, May says. It's not haunted, don't say that.
I was joking, I say, even though I kind of wasn't.
Relax, Molly says. None of us believes in that bullshit.
Except you, Mabes, I say, giving her spooky fingers.
I'm from the South.
Elise believes in ghosts, Julie says. I do too. I don't believe in ghosts, I say. I like ghost stories. I like any good story. If anyone's room is haunted, it's definitely mine, Julie says.
It's some Scooby-Doo shit, I'm not gonna lie, Molly says. Moving bookcase? It looks like one of the mansions in an episode of Scooby-Doo.
Oh my God, May says, face in hands.
What?
Molly asks. I'm serious, you know I'm right. Julie laughs, and she's more familiar to me now. I'm laughing too.
So, good news is, if there is a ghost, you can just pull the mask off and it'll be Patsy, Molly says.
Poor Patsy, May sighs.
Actually, Julie says after finishing her second potato and washing it down with whatever's left of her drink, I think I'm good on another round. Do you guys want one?
I'm fine, May says. Same, I say. Molly shakes her head.
I just got really tired,
Julie says and yawns.
Really tired.
She looks tired. Her eyes are sunken, orbited by dark shadows.
You want to go to bed?
Molly asks.
Yeah, actually, is that okay? I can meet up for breakfast tomorrow.
Sure, May says. I was thinking we could meet down here at 9. Does that work? Nods all around.
Okay, Julie says.
Molly gets up to let her out.
Good night. Love you.
Night, we say. Love you. We're quiet as we watch her walk out. On her way, she stops to pick up the fallen chair. We wait a long time to say anything to one another.
Does anyone want dessert?
May asks. Last time, I got this really amazing bread pudding.
Dessert?
Molly asks.
Yeah, I could go for some dessert.
Always, I say. I do want dessert. But even if I didn't, I would welcome the confectionery distraction. Anything to put off the inevitable conversation about Jules. I look around for the waiter. There's no waiter. There's nobody. That hasn't dawned on me until now. We're alone.
It's weird there's no one else in the dining room.
There's a couple, May says. I saw them. They're on the other side.
Where is everyone else? I'm surprised it's not packed.
It's new. They're in the process of building their brand. I thought you said it was booked up.
That's what they told me, yes. I'm sure more people will come tomorrow, Friday.
The quiet comes again. I keep looking for the waiter, but I see only empty tables, tea light candles burning feebly, chairs pushed in. As if he can hear us or read our thoughts, the waiter comes over with dessert menus. We make him wait while we debate the options. We decide to share the peanut butter bread pudding and the apple blueberry crumble. We all get coffee, and it appears seconds later like magic. We sip the coffee in silence. "All right," May says, folding her hands in her lap. "I want to say that I don't think we should talk about Julie when she isn't here. After what she's been through, I don't think it's fair." "Were we talking about Julie?" Molly asks.
"No, but it's coming," May says.
"Well, what the fuck?" Molly says. "Rare steak? Rare? Like what?"
"Maybe the doctors told her she has to eat red meat," May says. "She could be anemic."
"Then why wouldn't she just say that?" Molly asks.
"We don't know what happened to her in the past 2 years," May says.
"Apparently she doesn't either," I say.
"Even if she does," May says, "it obviously wasn't good. She'll talk to us about it when she's ready. But she won't if we come out guns blazing with the questions and judgments."
"I'm not judging," Molly says. "But why am I not allowed to ask questions? It's shady as fuck."
"Patience. That's all I'm asking. That we be patient. Make her feel comfortable."
"I'm not comfortable," I say. "It's not just the way she looks. It's not just the steak. It's how she's acting. Asking me about my dad? She's not herself."
"And she probably knows it. We don't want to make her feel any worse than she already does," May says. She's playing with her hair now because she's annoyed or overwhelmed. Both.
"It's going to get to a point where it's obvious," I say. "She'll pick up on it." "It'll be worse if she thinks we're lying to her," Molly says.
"We're not lying," May says, offended by the implication. "We're being patient, observing. Maybe she had an off night. Maybe her issues with food have resurfaced. We need to be supportive as her friends."
"I'm fine with being supportive," Molly says, then pauses for the waiter to drop off the desserts and get out of range. "I'm not cool with having to bullshit. I'm not going to censor myself. I'm just going to say it. She looks fucking terrible. She looks sick. And Elise is right. She's not acting like herself. Something's going on. Can we agree on that?"
"Yes, but," May starts.
"I won't come hot out of the gate," Molly says, "but I'm not leaving here without getting some honest answers out of her. We can't help her if we're going to handle her with kid gloves or whatever. I'm not going to bullshit to spare her feelings. That's not being a friend, yeah?"
"Yeah,"
May says, conquered. She's eating a big spoonful of whipped cream. "I don't know if I care so much about getting answers," I say. As I hear my words out loud, they sound true. "I just want her to go back to being Julie."
"We all want that," May says, "but maybe it's a selfish expectation."
"I want to enjoy this bread pudding without thinking about it anymore," Molly says.
"All right," I say,
"tabling for tonight." "It is good bread pudding, isn't it?" May asks. "I want to eat this every day for the rest of my life," Molly says, grinning. And then everything is fine and easy. None of us mentions Julie. We say goodnight to Molly at the foot of the stairs. "Off to spend the night in the jungle," she says with sarcastic enthusiasm. May sighs.
"I thought she would like it."
"She's joking," I tell her. "It's Molly. She can't admit to liking anything." "I know," she says. "I worry you guys don't like it here. You don't like your rooms. I really want this weekend to be fun and special. We don't get to see each other like we used to, and it's only going to get harder." Mabes. "What if we get married and have babies?" "Okay, well, Molly and I are degenerates. I doubt we'll go the wife and mother route. And I would hope Julie isn't anywhere close to considering kids. If you and your beautiful model girlfriend decide to have a chic Vogue wedding, I'll be there. And if you decide to have babies, I'll be your live-in nanny, and you'll see me every day." I thought you didn't want to move back to the city.
Maybe by then, I say.
Don't get my hopes up. Okay, forget I said anything. I think my room is this way.
Yeah, right here.
Good night. I open my arms for a hug.
I don't want to let her go. I don't want to be alone in this hotel.
The thought surprises me. I'm used to being alone, to sleeping alone, walking alone, everything alone. But as I look down the hall, the way back to my room, something about it is foreboding. It's dark. The lighting isn't normal hotel lighting, the standard bland but sufficient. Here, lanterns dangle from the walls, inside them alternating blue and purple bulbs. The result is hazy, bruised light.
Sweet dreams, May says. She's closing the door.
I want to shout for her to wait, ask if it's okay if I stay with her. The idea of walking back to my room has set like concrete. Standing around is worse. It's dead silent. The stairs are behind me, doors all around. I'm on display. Unseen guests are waiting on the other side of the closed doors, watching me through the peepholes, or they're creeping up the stairs. Soon their heads will come up above the top step, and by then it'll be too late.
Jesus,
I say out loud, breaking the silence. I'm being insane. It's getting to the point where I'm worrying myself, always being afraid like this. I'm going to end up one of those paranoiacs who live in booby-trapped bunkers, eating canned peaches with rusty spoons. Roll the shoulders back, chin up, walk it off. I'm an adult. This is an empty hallway. There's nothing to be scared of. I start to walk. I take cool, calculated steps like a bridesmaid. My arms sway at my sides. They swish against my clothes. My footsteps sound heavier than they should. The floorboards hidden underneath the carpet creak. I count. One, two, one, two, one, two, one, two, three, four. I pivot so fast, I trip over my own foot. There was another set of footsteps. Someone walking behind me, right behind me, hiding in my shadow, out of my line of God! I untangle my feet and take a deep breath. What if I fell? My cheeks expand with heat. I touch my face. I'm flush. The hall is empty. No one was following me. The only footsteps were my own, and the echo of them allowed by this quiet space. It's behind you now. I turn back. Nothing. When you look away, it skitters behind you. You'll never see it. I quicken my pace. My hands tremble, holding the stupid, heavy key. The lock clicks, and I push open the door, reaching inside for the light switch. I feel around for it, find it. When the lights come on, I slip inside and close the door behind me. Lock it. Exhale. The feeling of safety I expected to greet me isn't here. Instead, I'm met with uncertainty. I'm sure the room isn't how I left it. The chairs and the couch have switched positions. The mirror is farther along the wall, not across from the TV anymore. There are different pillows on the couch. The headboard is taller. I don't remember the pattern on the carpet, but I don't know how I missed it. Flowers, of course. Turquoise with little pink flowers. I didn't put the do not disturb sign on the knob. It's possible Patsy or the cleaning staff came in. But why would they move the furniture? And they couldn't have changed the carpet. I'm sure, though. This I'm sure about. This isn't me being crazy or having drunk too much whiskey. Something's changed, moved, is out of place. A few steps inside, and I doubt myself. The chairs were there. The mirror is across from the TV. It is the liquor. It is me. I rummage through my duffel for my pajamas, change, get out my plastic bag full of toiletries, and go into the bathroom. I check the corners for spiders. I wash my face and brush my teeth. Skip flossing. I leave the bathroom light on and the door cracked. I turn off the rest of the lights and climb into bed. The duvet is heavy and warm, thankfully, because it's still cold in here. I kick my feet around to settle inside it. I'm glad I left the bathroom light on. Falling asleep somewhere new has always been hard for me. I would take an Ambien, but I've been drinking. Too bad. I took one last night, and it helped. I close my eyes. Count backward from 100. Imagine an hourglass tipping over, the sand trickling through. I transport myself to a beach, sunshine nuzzling my face as I search for sea glass. An unknowable amount of time passes. I turn onto my side. My eyes pop open. I stare at the curtains. They sway as my eyes adjust, almost like something moves behind them. The door. The door outside, to the balcony. I shoot up, push the curtains aside, and test the knob. It's locked. What's wrong with me? I tuck myself in, turn my back against the wall to face the room. I hear a wheezing noise, and I know it's the air coming in through the vents. I know that, but still, I imagine there's someone standing next to my bed, watching me, breathing heavily. My mind projects the image of a witch, dirty, matted hair, gray skin, black eyes, and a cold, evil mouth. Hands mottled with open sores, long green fingernails about to touch me. I flip onto my other side, face the windows. No witch, no one. But what if someone's behind one of the columns, thin enough to be concealed? What if they're waiting? What if they're slipping around now? I make a split-second decision. I push the covers back and bolt over to the main light switch, the fear rising in me like carbonation. I slam my palm against the switch and the lights come on. The room is empty. Guess I'll sleep with the lights on, I mumble out loud, hoping the sound of a voice, even if it's my own, will trick me out of my fear. The light is a comfort, but it won't make it any easier for me to sleep. Whenever I get insomnia like this, I think about Julie. Sharing a room with her for 4 years spoiled me. We would talk each other to sleep, trade stories across the narrow chasm between our extra-long twin beds. If our conversation was dying, or if she sensed I was drifting off while she was still wide awake, she would ask me the most random question she could think of. Do you think God created dinosaurs? Do you think elves are real? How come people don't have other color eyes, like rainbow eyes? I'd react by sitting up and asking, "What?" She'd laugh and laugh. Then I would be awake too. She was always good at getting what she wanted. I admired that, but it also stirred envy in me. There were times when her questions didn't work, when I didn't answer because I ceded to sleep before I could cede to her. Whenever that happened, she would climb into bed with me. Not in a male fantasy kind of way. It wasn't like that. It was innocent. The first time she did it, I thought it was a joke. I thought that she was trying to prove a point, or to keep me up. That she really, really needed the attention. I laughed. I figured she would go back to her own bed in a few minutes. I patted her on the head. I waited for her to leave, but she never did. She stayed. Those dorm room beds are so narrow, the two of us barely fit. She rested her head on my shoulder. Our limbs were piled up. Her hair smelled like fruity shampoo, like mango. I was uncomfortable, but eventually I slept. And when we woke up the next morning, it wasn't awkward. I didn't think anything of it. It didn't compute. We brushed our teeth and went on with our day. It hit me later, as I sat in some yellowy lecture hall. I had this swell of memory. Julie slept in my bed last night. Does it mean something? How do I feel about it? Is it normal? Should I bring it up? Will she try again? She didn't that night. she stayed in her own bed. But a few weeks later, she was back. This time it was because she was sad. She was after this guy, Paul, who was the epitome of nothing special. But that was irrelevant to Julie. She would chase him until he relented. It was a pride thing. Paul was famous on campus for being the son of the liquor king. His dad owned a chain of liquor stores and did those cheesy come on down TV commercials, wearing a fur cape and a plastic crown. Paul put his liquor prince status to good use, ferrying alcohol onto campus for a hefty fee. It gave him more clout than he deserved. Paul got a lot of girls. A lot. That enticed Julie, in the way that Mount Everest entices some people when they read that others have died climbing it. She was telling me how she was upset over something Paul said to her, something I remember she was reading too far into, and she came into my bed again. She smushed me against the wall, and I let her because she was sad, because I felt sorry for her, and because I didn't know how to extricate myself from the situation. I put my arm around her so it wouldn't go stiff beneath me, and she took my hand. I thought she might be crying, but I couldn't tell. There were other times, too. It happened enough for it not to be special, but not enough for it to be creepy. After a while, I got used to it, liked it even. I told myself it was because it made me feel good to comfort her, but really it was because I needed the comfort, too. I could use it now. Even with the lights on, there's something off about this room. I must fall asleep because I dream. I'm dreaming. In this dream, I reach over for my phone and text Julie. Are you up? Yep, she says. Can't sleep? Nope. You either? Nope. Come by. I put on my shoes and ask her for her room number, but she doesn't respond. I scroll up and we haven't been texting at all. There are no messages in our history. None. I think I can find her room. I think I remember from earlier. I take my key, my phone. I wrap myself up in my favorite oversized sweatshirt. I walk. Past May's room, down the stairs. Nothing makes any sound. Not the vents. Not my breath, not my feet on the floor. I float. I know it's her room because the door is open, just a crack. From a distance, I can see a faint light, maybe from a lamp or the bathroom. She, like me, needs a little light. The pitch darkness makes us uneasy. I can't tell where the light is coming from. It's green. I open my mouth to call out for her, but my throat is dry. Her name dissolves on my tongue and leaves a bitter taste. I try again, but this time it hurts like a sickness, like strep or a virus, like little white spots you can see in the mirror with a flashlight if you say, ah. I'm afraid, not with the sensation that there's something behind me, out of view, though something is behind me, pushing me forward. It's like there are two wet palms on my shoulder blades. I can feel them, but I don't fear them. I fear what's ahead of me, but I can't stop myself from moving forward. I can't turn around. It's out of my control. There's a shape in the shadows, not the bed, over the bed, on the other side of the bed, crouching in the corner. Knees and elbows up, sharp at strange angles. Like a tortured crab, head down, over something. Something dark and limp and dripping. And there are noises, bad noises. Eating, sloppy eating. Not eating, feeding. The thing looks up at me, and it's Julie. But it's not Julie. Hideous mouth open, red, 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 red. Even in the dim light, I can see the red. Pointed teeth. Rows of them, like a shark's. Things hanging between. I've never seen a mouth so wide. Only it's not the mouth, it's the jaw. It's come undone. It's disconnected from the rest of the face. The only thing holding its skull together is skin. It sees me, but it doesn't acknowledge me. It looks at me with empty eyes and, after a moment, returns to the limp thing. Whatever the limp thing is, it's big enough to be a person. Another noise, a guttural one, a grotesque, hard swallow. I back away through the door. There's nothing pushing me forward now, so I go back. Back to my room, lock the door, back to bed. Close my eyes, fall asleep. Wait to wake up from the dream.